Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Greetings, and welcome to The Donkey and the Bridge, a blog and podcast that serves as a confluence of voices and insights that bridge perspectives and translate difference to one another. I'm your host, Christos Galanis, and today I'm joined by Stephen Jenkinson, teacher, author, farmer, cultural activist, and breaker of spells. Stephen and his wife, Natalie, are the founders of the Orphan Wisdom School, an extraordinary enterprise that often convenes within the grounds of their living farm in Eastern Ontario, Canada. I've been a student of Stephen's teachings for many years now, graduating from the Orphan Wisdom School in 2017 with more questions than I went in with. In all my goings and searchings, I've yet to come across another teacher like Stephen. His quality of love for this world in all its brokenness and heartbreak is humbling and awe-inspiring, and what he's been able to cobble together from that relentless heartbrokenness is difficult to describe or capture in words. He was generous enough to agree to some time with me at the conclusion of a 6-day gathering on his farm for Orphan Wisdom School graduates on a beautiful summer's morning, where the conversation was rich and entangled, encompassing wonderings on land and culture, ancestry and belonging, colonization and nostalgia. We also discussed his latest book, Come of Age, The Case for Elderhood in a Time of Trouble, which was released in early July of 2018. I hope you enjoy the conversation we shared, and if you're interested in further following along with what Stephen Jenkinson is up to, you can check out his webpage at orphanwisdom.com for more info on his books, teachings, and upcoming tour dates. Much gratitude as well to James Nowak for his assistance with this interview, and to Natalie Waugh and the other fine humans on the farm who hosted us that week. So good morning, Stephen Jenkinson.
Good morning.
Thanks for speaking with me. I was wondering if you can just describe where we are right now.
Me? Describe it?
Yeah. I mean, I can say we're on your farm in Eastern Ontario.
Yeah, you're on my farm, and you're in a hall that we built 2 years ago, a teaching hall, post and beam hall, very compelling place that was built by four young guys who were terrified, which is a really good work crew to have. Mm-hmm. I didn't terrify them, mind you, but they were terrified, and because the interview process lasted two questions, which any interview process, if it lasts longer than that, is some other thing. And the first question was, have you ever done anything like what I'm dreaming of? No, they said. And the second question was, do you think you can do it? And they all said no. So I thought, well, this is a qualified operation. Because if they had lied on either one of those things, you could smell it, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to lie about being afraid of something. It's quite faithful, and it really enunciates itself, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it did. And they turned into a medieval craft guild, basically before my eyes. Mm. One of them had done an apprenticeship in Switzerland, in post and beam construction. So there are two things there. One is post and beam knowledge, but the other one's the knowledge of apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. And this is by far the more valuable mm-hmm. thing. You can't acquire apprenticeship if you don't go through it. But you can acquire post and beam if you don't go through apprenticeship.
Right.
But you put them together, it's magic. And it was magic. And the last thing I'll tell you is, you're looking around here, you can see it's skeletal in so clearly skeletal. Mm-hmm. And we're on the inside of the skeleton. Mm-hmm. So there's the rib cage above us and the spinal column there and the hips, right? And of course the mouth and the ears and so on, all the openings. Mm-hmm. And everything's anatomical as it properly has always been until fairly recently. Mm-hmm. And the mitering and so forth, the truing of the timbers was all done way down the hill, nowhere close to up here.
Okay.
It was done horizontally. Mm-hmm. Because just to move them was an insane undertaking.
You don't want to do that work up there?
No.
Yeah.
No. So we did it all, and we had done the floor, and we brought it up, and the entire thing was erected in a day and a half. The bones were all up in a day and a half, which testifies to the extraordinary willingness they had to be disciplined. Mm-hmm. And we joked, but it was an authentic joke, that the tolerance on this job was 1/32nd of an inch. That's the variance that would still allow the thing to work. Because mm-hmm. you come up here, and these things aren't screwed or nailed together, they're pegged. So mm-hmm. everything had to align, like I said, to the 32nd of an inch. And it sounds, you know, to people who don't understand what that means, it sounds intolerant, or even, as they like to say now, anal. But look, sometimes you need precision. And there's nothing tyrannous about precision, mm-hmm. right? And they found it. So that's what we're sitting in the middle of, and it's this is ringing still with a concert from last night, which was the end of the school. And we've had many school sessions here, a few weddings, a few altercations, and a good number of banquets on these trestle tables that are behind me here. And the sun is spectacular, and what do you call it when you don't get rain? Drought. And the drought is finally, the drought affects your thinking.
Yeah.
The drought is finally broken, thankfully. Uh-huh. And the corn is growing just outside our door. And the sheep will be moved into the pasture we're in the middle of tomorrow. So you're in a real place.
Okay. So I first met you in Devon, England, several years ago. And I've been coming here to the farm the last couple of years and learning under you. And in front of you, sometimes very nakedly in front of you in this hall. And I first came to you through Grief Walker and your work on death and dying. And it became pretty obvious to me once coming here that that was maybe perhaps not the central issue at play. And your most recent book that just came out a month ago is on elderhood, come of age.
Mm-hmm.
What's the rest of the come of age?
Come of age, the case for elderhood in a time of trouble.
Yeah, and so I...
Not personal trouble.
Right. Cultural trouble.
Yeah.
And so what we've spent a lot of time listening to you talking about the last 6 days here is this issue of elderhood. And so I have an arc to the questions that I'm asking to get us there. If I can lay a bit of groundwork of where I'm coming from as a cultural geographer who looks at really time and space and culture. And so what I've come to understand of a colonial project, at least the European colonial project, I can't speak to other cultural parallel processes, is the centrality of progress that is bound to everything that we understand about reality in this culture. And so what I've understood, let's say, you know, I've been living in England and studying English colonial history mostly the last few years, is that it was understood by the people embarking on this project that as they moved away from England, and I'll use Australia as probably the best example, they were, by expanding imperial territory, they were progressing. The idea that, like, the empire was progressing by growing, by taking up more space.
Right.
And so the voyage from England to Australia and the conquering was seen as progress. At the same time, the further you got from Europe into non-Europe, the further back in time you were traveling. So the idea, almost like a portal, so the further away from Europe you got, the more primitive the cultures became. And of course, Australia was perceived as probably the
more like old Europe things were.
Yeah.
The farther away you get from Europe, the more like old Europe things become.
Yeah. And that idea of going back in time and going back and touching the primitive. And then the return voyage, let's say from Australia, is recreating the evolution, progress, returning back to the pinnacle of evolution, of time and progress. And we've talked a lot about progress and potential, especially with you here. I'm wondering, If you can speak to, I mean, I can trace it back at least to Judaism, the idea of progress. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming, because everything goes back further than that, but what, and I don't know if other cultures share anything like this mania for progress. And I'm wondering what you've been able to excavate, perhaps, in your wonderings of where this mania for progress comes from in our culture.
Well, I think there's two, first of all, two layers to the inquiry. Uh-huh. And one of them is a progress that's avowed and, let's call it, self-conscious, deliberate, that's in the... it's in the adjectival train that follows behind every endeavor. Right. You find it's not an accident and it's not a secret. Mm-hmm. But progress as an insinuating template is not necessarily that self-evident to its practitioners.
Right.
They can't distinguish it, for example, from, quote, the way it is. Mm-hmm. You know. So many of these things are bound to your understanding of time. Or your misunderstanding, or your reluctance to understand it, or your never having understood it, of time.
Right.
Right. So this progress requires a couple of things for its architecture to hold. One of them is sequence. So there's a purposeful relationship between the integers, between the vertebra, between the incidents. Mm-hmm. Right. There's that. And it has to be fairly tangible to register, for example, not as regress or egress. Mm-hmm. But progress.
Or recession, or all these words. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the sequence has to be, I think, uh-huh, something thematic, not simply registering one thing after another, mm-hmm, and imagining a progress from that. But you actually see it dragging itself up the hill, telling itself a story. And the story is what it's doing. Mm-hmm. But of course, the story really is to mitigate everything around that's not progressive, mm-hmm, quote unquote, not progressive. But the only way not progressive appears is in the presence of progress. It's the only way white people appear is in the presence of anyone who doesn't answer to the description.
Right.
So it's the same with progress, I suspect, that progress is not a naturally occurring thing. You know, that you have to wage war on a lot of things that are presenting themselves to you to come up with progress, mm-hmm, right? It's, you don't derive it from a walk in the park or something, you know. It's at some level, it's argumentative, seems to me. Mm-hmm. The architecture of progress is a little bit belligerent and a little bit, much in the manner of hope, I would, uh-huh, say, that I can recognize it just as I think of it now, a kind of... carbon template. You know, one is the flip in some fashion, the other, how so? Well,
of hope and progress.
Yeah, hope is something I've had some experience with.
Yeah.
I've been, you know, beaten about the head and shoulders by hope. I used to work in the death trade considerably, and hope was the mothership of the entire enterprise. Mm-hmm. In other words, the alleged origin of what? Of all of the comfort-giving measures doled out to dying people and their families. But hope is not a comfort-generating technique. No, it's not. It informs all the techniques, and it tinges them with this allegation of comfort. The comfort hue, mm-hmm, comes from hope. Right? But what is hope fundamentally in its dynamic architecture? Regardless of what people intend by it when they invoke it or even use the word, it's not that significant. And you don't determine what hope means when the word hope comes out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You are conjuring something that's already available. So hope in its architecture has the function of finding the present circumstance in some fashion or other, either unwieldy, unworthy, unrealistic, unnecessary, certainly not preferable. And you could just go downhill to more aggressive increments from there. Mm-hmm. So hope, the best way I found to articulate it in a sentence is to say, is anybody in this room hoping that they're in this room? Is anybody sitting there listening to me, hoping that they're sitting there listening to me? Mm-hmm. Is anybody sitting there hoping they're sitting there hoping? Anything. So what's the point? Well, it sounds like a kind of word convolution, mm-hmm. but it's not at all. It's not a simple flipping. It means this. Do you occupy the place that you are granted right now? You and I sitting across from each other. Mm-hmm. And that mysteriously hope is necessary in order for you to occupy the chair opposite me.
You're saying that hope is necessary?
No, I'm saying that's the hope's program.
Right.
It doesn't wonder about that.
Yeah.
It doesn't even infer it. It proceeds accordingly. That hope is necessary in order for you to sit on the chair and for us to talk back and forth. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that's not necessary. Mm-hmm. Because hope is really not, doesn't establish you here and now. Mm-hmm. Hope orients you to the not yet, or the could be, mm-hmm. or the should be, or the would that it be, or the supposed to, of everything that the present lacks. So hope is informed by poverty, mm-hmm. right? And you hope for a better day, you hope for a better deal, and all of these things, and you engage in any hopefulness, it turns you away from being able to occupy. Maybe that's not the best word, or maybe given a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It's not a bad word.
Yeah.
I don't mean own by occupy, I mean to be utterly located.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. That hope forbids you to be located in the present, because the present is never adequate mm-hmm. to a hopeful person. That's why the question about are you hoping that you're sitting here? Mm-hmm. You'd never do that. Why? Because your ability to sit here is not predicated on it getting better. Mm-hmm. Or hoping for more. You see, it's those things are a way of seeing to it that you don't quite settle in the chair. Mm-hmm. That you're working towards something that's not so now.
Right.
So it's all future oriented, mm-hmm. and it preys upon the idea that you can you not craft fairly readily a general dissatisfaction with the present circumstances in about a second? Name anything. Is it warm enough for you? Is it good? Do you have enough water? Is this, you know, how's the chair? Mm-hmm. You know, this is all predicated on what we could do something.
Right.
How do you like the sunlight? Mm-hmm. How do you like Monday? Mm-hmm. We can do something about what we can meet tomorrow. And on and on and on. Mm-hmm. It never ends. Mm-hmm. There's something, as you can see, I think,
yeah.
inherently hopeful about the spell of progress. Mm-hmm. That it's predicated on the idea that this will not do. It used to do. That's what they never say, this part. What do you mean it used to do? Mm-hmm. Well, until it turned into this, we were trying to get to this. Mm-hmm. So at one time, this was the hope for something.
Yeah.
However you want to characterize it, geopolitically, you know, dynamically, ecologically, yeah. whatever it is. But we were trying to get here.
Yeah.
And of course, well, there's a few misfortunes along the way, so it hasn't quite turned out.
Someone's fault that it didn't turn out the way we
had. Yeah, it's usually big something's fault.
Right.
Right. The little people's fault, never.
Right.
Because we're always on the receiving end of big
yeah.
agri, big pharma, etc. You know, yeah. military industrial complex, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So progress is imagining its own career. It gives itself work to do. Mm-hmm. In that sense, progress as a prejudice is like a fireman, a bored fireman, starting a fire.
Right.
Okay, you craft disaffection. Mm-hmm. As a prerequisite to, let's go over that hill. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we just say that there's something on the other side of the hill? Mm-hmm. Why don't we grant it that? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to go there? We don't have to go there, but we should go there. What's the difference? Well, mm-hmm. the should comes from the progress mind. Mm-hmm. Because if our forefathers, I don't know why it's always that. Mm-hmm. I've never heard anybody say foremother, but anyway.
Yeah.
If our forefathers weren't possessed of a certain degree of basic dissatisfaction about the thing, we would never have ended up here.
Yeah.
So you just follow that and it becomes a kind of an ancestral obligation. Certainly in the example that you gave me of going to Australia.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing is, for a long time I'm quite sure, and it may still be true, that Australia way more English than England. right?
Yeah.
So one more thing about
sure,
this.
Yeah.
It happened in this room some years ago. There was a woman just over there by the stove, and she was from Italy. And she asked me some kind of question about ancestry. And in the question was a kind of fairly classical European's sense of a not very vague feel of superiority on these matters.
About culture itself?
Well, about culture and about the inalienably improving presence of classical culture and things of this order, right?
Okay.
Not necessarily Italian, but she was referring to that.
Yeah.
And as she was spinning this out, you know, I wasn't in any way agitated or offended about it, largely because, oh yeah, this one again. But because a thought occurred to me that had never occurred to me before, and I said to her in response, you know, of course, that we're more European than you are. Mm-hmm. And the whole place just stopped. Even the North Americans looked at me like, what could that possibly mean?
Yeah.
That can't even be true. No, we're more European than you. How does that work? And this is apropos of progress. I think it works like this. So it's hard to say the word we and make this make sense, but let's just try. So we came here, 250, depending on where you're talking about, in which country of origin.
Yeah.
Let's say 250 years ago. Do you know what happens when my French-Canadian wife goes to France and speaks French? Outside of Paris, I should say, outside of Paris. Mm-hmm. She's deemed to be quaint and cute in the manner of a kind of memento that has no tangible reality, but is a vague reminder of something, of a bygone day that was in its own way cute and compelling, but can't survive any meaningful comparison to the majesty of our accomplishments since then. Mm-hmm. That's what she gets.
Yeah.
And so they ask her to speak French, which they're saying, of course, isn't really French. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you know what I'm going to say next. It's older French than any of them know how to speak.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Any of them. Okay. And her French-ness is older than theirs.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So in that understanding, which is a fairly compelling one to me, there is a degree of European-ness that came across the waters that nestled and did other things too here. And by virtue of being dislocated from the mother ship, didn't wither, wilt, and die and get blown away into the dust of time, but was a kind of Frenchness or Englishness or Scotsness or Welshness or Irishness. And you know, speaking of the Europeans that were around this area we're speaking in now. And that those qualities are more closely bound to the current European's ancestry than the current European could ever materially practice or linguistically practice.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary thought to think that we're more European, never having been there, than the Europeans who occupy the dirt now. You know, and I know it's an aggressive thing to say more European, but I'm qualifying it by what I mean by European. You know, if, does European fundamentally mean derived from things European?
From that land.
Ultimately from the land.
Yeah.
But all of the life ways that ensue by the slings and arrows of everything that's gone on in the time since the Middle Passage, let's say, the last 300 years until today, that's made the Europe of today in Europe.
Right.
But none of the Europeans here were crafted by the stuff that's happened since.
Right.
They were crafted by the dislocation from it. But that doesn't, I don't think, limit its Europeanness. It may crystallize and condense it instead. And so that's last thing to say is the sense of progress, as I understand it, the consequence is that the current Europeans have less of a capacity to live out their Europeanness by virtue of the mania for progress. Whereas the dislocated Europeanness that became North America had no obligation to progress in its Europeanness, to find yet another incarnation of it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying, of course, it's not a pure incarnation of anything over here, because there was a lot of colonial experience that had its own consequence. But as a, you know, to arbitrarily point to a time and talk about, you know, the idea of progress, mm-hmm. I think the understanding holds that I've just said.
And there's this idea of authenticity, and this is what I'm tracing a lot because, you know, my research has been in the Highlands of Scotland, and what I discovered pretty early on is that when Scottish fiddlers want to learn the real, quote, the real Gaelic fiddle, they go to Cape Breton.
Yeah, Cape Breton.
And in Cape Breton, they still speak Gaelic.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the same time, I can go out to a club in Edinburgh and see some young Scottish guys, you know, doing hip-hop, like freestyling.
Right.
And to them, that is, that's Edinburgh today, right?
Right.
It's hip-hop. Yeah. And so this idea of progress, you end up breaking up into multiple timelines or linearities, and the question becomes, what is real Scotland? Is it what's happening amongst the people currently living in Scotland, or is it the people in Cape Breton who carry, you know, the songs and the stories from 200 years
ago? I tell you that I think
ago.
It's a poor question to ask.
Sure.
The word real before it. It really skews things.
Yeah.
I use the word there. In a desperate way, you know. It's, there is no real Scotland.
Right.
Except to a Platonist. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some kind of magical, unerring Scottishness.
Yeah.
That lives, what does it live in the crannies? Does it live in the where nobody lives? Is that where you find it? Do you find it somewhere where nobody's got a radio?
Yeah.
Or what? I mean, what has to not be there for the real Scots thing to be there?
This is what. So I'll just say, I'm not saying that one is more real. It's the question I ask people in Scotland, especially.
Yeah. You ask them about the real Scotland?
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's what I'm doing. My ethnography is.
Okay.
Because I'm tracing people that are summiting. Mm. Mountains in the Highlands, and they lose their shit if they run into any people or any ruins of, you know, cottages from the people that have been cleared from those landscapes. So it's this idea of requiring an empty landscape that can act as a portal back to an authentic Scotland.
Okay.
Right? And Brexit is still perpetuating this idea that, you know, you have to preserve real England. But in some ways you could say, by that standard, real Scotland is in Cape Breton. If you're using that argument that the past is more real, right?
Yeah.
And I can say as, you know, a child of immigrants from Greece who came here in the 60s, because I learned Greek from them, when I go to Greece and speak Greek, people laugh at me because they're like, you sound like you're from the 60s.
Really? It's changed that much
yeah.
that they can locate you in the 60s?
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows what Greek is, given that?
And a lot of it has been, you know, anglicized. That's the ironic thing,
sure.
right? To them, the real Greek has all these, like, Anglo,
yes.
you know.
Yes, sure.
All these terms. And you know, the diaspora in Toronto, you know, for garage, we say garagi. You know, so you have all that kind of, like, making Greek of English words, which, don't, you know, don't necessarily exist over there. So these ideas of, if you want to call it authenticity and who belongs authentically or which landscape is the authentic landscape. And it gets into a lot of, well, maybe this gets to my next question. About the role of elderhood and limits. So we're talking about progress. And of course, everything in our culture is soaked with the idea that to progress is good and to break through limits or through boundaries is imperative, and this is good.
Except to break through imperative.
Exactly.
Except for that one.
Yeah, which is quite a limitation of imagination.
It's a desperate limitation to agree to limitlessness.
So I have an excerpt from your recent book. Do you want to read it in your voice, or do you want me to?
No, you go ahead. I'd like to hear it.
To hear it? Sure.
Yeah.
So coming out of the idea of progress, and we talked about what culture is, and I think part of what we're talking about now is what is Scottish culture, what is Francophone culture, what is Anglo culture. So you've written, cultures are cultured not because they have more books or more leisure time or more well-being, but because they have glimpsed the deep, unwelcome consequences the concentration of too many people visit upon the place they claim to love as their home. The spirit algorithm of the thing is part tragedy, part love story. Societies are brought to the tempered achievement of culture by seeing and learning the end of what they hold dear, and then by entering into a self-governance of restraint and obedience to limit. Endings are the midwives of their ability to love their home places, their gods, their ancestral matrimony and patrimony.
Wow. That's great. I'd like to be able to read that book someday. There's a lot in there.
I haven't finished the book, so I gotta keep putting it down. And one thing that you shared in the last couple of days here, which again is almost this ultimately counterintuitive to what we've been talking about of what is an authentic connection to place or to culture, is that being faithful to one's place might mean, or has to eventually mean, ending the culture itself, or like ending your dwelling of that place.
Yeah,
dispersing. Right? Not ending the culture, but dispersing.
Yeah.
That is actually the most authentic way, ultimately, to be, what's the word? It's a verb, that to be faithful to a place.
Let me mess with the word authentic for a minute.
Yeah.
Not the word itself, but employing it for the sake of talking about this.
Sure.
I'd like to reimagine what authenticity is, if we're going to use the word at all, to be a condition of the place. But the way you use it, and of course the way virtually everyone uses it, is when we say more or less authentic, we mean something in the order of this, that it rings more true, more usefully true, and compellingly true, and therefore more truing for me. That's what the word authentic
is. My perception of what is.
Well, it's an interior state of mind.
Right.
The authenticity of Scotland.
It's political.
Is an interior reality for me.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that there's a corner of Scotland that's more authentic has some upside for me.
Yeah.
You know, either that because I'm seeking it or because I'm trying to shame it.
Right.
Which, of course, in days gone by, is what was sought. Absolutely. You look for the authentic Scotland to end it.
Yeah.
For example, you know. And where does that motivation come from? Same place it comes from when people seek it out in order to be ennobled by it. Mm-hmm. The same instinct is the authenticity is not an indwelling characteristic of the place, but it's a transferable kind of emotional skill that I have as a witness or as one subject to it, as if that's what it's there for.
Or an identity, one might say.
Well, that's what all these things come to.
Yes.
That's what an identity is, is how it works for me.
Yeah.
You know. But very rarely is the characteristic of authenticity attributed actually to the thing you think you're calling authentic.
Right.
How could it be authentic and you have no idea? Could it be authentic and it doesn't register upon you at all? It has no compelling power. And that this is one of the reasons authenticity has lasted.
Yeah.
Is because you skim over it so readily, seeking out a more compelling landscape, you know, or humanscape or something.
Yeah.
So this is not a detail, I don't think. It's a very big deal, this question of, you know, where's the Geiger counter for authenticity? And most people use it as it's part of my inner weather. And I'll know authenticity when I feel it.
Right.
See? Yeah. But it's very possible you can miss it altogether. And it might be part of the survival strategy of authentic places not to register upon humans. Maybe an adaptive capacity that's been developed over years.
Of the place itself.
Yeah. That you can imagine that's part of its ecology. And this is not misanthropic to imagine it.
Yeah.
It's not that the place is hostile to what would seem to require hostility. Sorry, that's not a good sentence. I'm not saying that the place itself has entered into a degree of misanthropic hostility as a way of responding to humans. That would be a human response to humans.
Right.
But it's not a place response to humans, I don't think. So I'm imagining this, by the way, right? That it could be in the order of ecological wisdom. That a place crafts the ability to not register upon those who would most employ it, extract from it, tend to visit it over and over again. Right? So then you could take this one step further and imagine the place is most compelling to humans. Are the places that have, in some fashion or other, volunteered to be the lightning rods for human attraction. In so doing, saving the quote-unquote lesser attractive places to be the real domicile of authenticity.
Right.
It's a wild thought to think.
Yeah.
It's never occurred to me before, but just as we're thinking about it now,
yeah,
it could well be so. Mm-hmm. And the places that elude our authenticity longing do so because they've worked it out. They've seen to it that authenticity will remain in the world. Because clearly, that's not our self-appointed task. Mm-hmm. Our self-appointed task is to be nourished and nurtured by authenticity, not to see to it that it's in the world regardless of how it works out for us.
Right.
Yeah.
Man, there's a lot.
There is. No, I didn't go anywhere near the question with that.
Yes.
Right? So I'm happy to do that if you'd like.
Well, I think, so based on what I've just read, what I want to come to is the word nostalgia.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which you gave us the etymology a couple of days ago, right, which is, I wrote down, is the return of pain.
So wild, yeah.
And so I've, so I'm, you know, my field work is based in the Highlands of Scotland, which, and I'm tracing from the 1500s, the banning of pilgrimage, which was often to sacred wells in the Reformation, and the banning of all ritual and ceremony other than the Sabbath, like everything, Christmas, everything was just completely erased. Yes. And I have accounts
around when?
Starting 1530s and into the early 1600s.
That's late.
For as that, I mean, this is Gaelic Scotland, right?
Right.
So you have to, first of all, have incursions.
Right.
So there is Christianity.
Yeah.
They're Christian, obviously, for many hundreds of years. But this idea that you have to break these traditions. And there's accounts of literally pilgrims trying to physically get to a sacred well. And you have magistrates and bailiffs and stuff literally blocking physically their path.
Right.
And they're kind of like, you know, there's a clash. Mm. And so what you have is, in the 1600s, still in the Hebrides, some resistance to this. People still, you know, trying to get to these sites. Into this late 1700s, people still pouring milk on fairy hills, you know, feeding their ancestors in the Isle of Lewis, for example. But by the 1800s, that's pretty much gone. And as those people start fleeing and coming here, you have people from the south, from the lowlands, entering into those mountains for the first time, discovering them. And the places they go to are the mountaintops, the summits. And part of, with what you've just shared is, let me backtrack a bit of where I felt this. It was in northern Chihuahua, where the Mescalero Apache have or had been living. And, you know, that's where Geronimo was kind of like chased to. That was like the last wild kind of Indian, you know, that hadn't been brought down.
Right.
And as soon as they brought him down, they put him in a cage and started taking him around to fairs and circuses.
Yeah.
But as they did that, all of a sudden, you know, Geronimo himself became an emblem for America, right?
Yeah. He was American now.
He became American, and he became the noble
savage
American, right?
Right?
And so it's a bit of a jump, but I actually want to jump to Psalm 137.
Why not?
Because I love this psalm, because there's something there.
I don't know it. So.
Okay. Rivers of Babylon.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it's this, it captures a nostalgia. So I have the New International Version.
Okay.
And I'll read.
No, these and thou's it.
Exactly. Yeah. I decided on this, not the King James. So I'll read some scripture. By the rivers. Oh, should I set this up first? Maybe so listeners know. So this is the first Exodus. This is the Babylonian Exodus. The Israelites have been conquered and captured and taken to Babylon. And they're away from Jerusalem. They're away from their God. And they're struggling to preserve the memory of place.
Mm.
So by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion or Israel. There on the poplars, we hung our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, Lord, when the Edomites, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried, tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. So I know that in our culture we're meant to identify with the Israelites. And what I've come to realize is that actually we're the Babylonians who are asking the indigenous people of that land, let's say of Israel, to sing a song of joy, to share their ceremonies, to share their protocols. And that's the nostalgia for me. For me, this is the story of the Babylonians themselves revealing this longing for the thing that they've just crushed and conquered, and to touch something authentic again through what they've just eradicated.
Because, is this what you're imagining? That one of the consequences of conquest, it's kind of the corrosive scorpion's tail of the beast, is that the more you engage in colonizing, the more compromises your capacity for cultural authenticity.
Because literally, the further you go out in space and progress, right, the further from
I don't know if it's by virtue of a spatial dislocation.
Or in time as well.
Yeah, but I think there's something about the transgressive nature of colonizing other people, or missionizing other people, we should say, that so fundamentally disqualifies your own capacity for your own cultural integrity, I think. That's the absolutely unanticipated consequence, that you could enter into this kind of chicanery, you know, this kind of extraordinary ethnic cleansing, as if your ethnos is the one to be emulated by everyone else. But acting upon that conviction seems to disqualify your ethnos now. Or you could go further and say your ethnos is disqualification, is disintegration, is the undoing of culture. That becomes your personal anti-culture. And whoever bargains for that, you know, that you build all these monuments to your victory, and every stone is taken from the foundation of your culture. It's pulled out from
your
underneath
own culture.
Your culture. Yes, exactly.
I'm just thinking of the Zócalo in Mexico City,
for example,
at the Aztec temple,
right,
and building the cathedral. Right. But you're talking about that those... you saying that those bricks from the temple are actually being drawn from Hispanic culture itself?
This needs about two sentences of elaboration to make it make sense. Because obviously, we know archaeologically, and it's a staggering thing to know, that when they were tearing the Aztec temples apart, which is around the corner, you can see the place today, literally around the corner, they took the stones... They squared them on 5 sides.
Okay, squared each stone.
Like all the sides that showed. Okay, that had to work geometrically, but that also showed. And the only one that they didn't purify was the underside.
Right.
And if you turn them, you could see Aztec gods on the underside of the stones that made the cathedral. In Mexico City. Okay. So at that level, people who are listening know that story, at least intuitively. We know it's happened many times. So you could say, well, I thought you were saying that what the Spaniards did was pull the foundation stones of the Aztec culture to make their New Spain culture in Mexico. Yes, that's accurate, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm imagining this. There is a kind of primordial / existential consequence that accrues to the Spanish for doing such a thing. And it's not punishment, it's much worse. And it goes like this. The willingness to do that to other people is its own architectural enterprise. And to use the image of architecture and building, there's a foundation upon which they're building New Spain. And the irony is that all of the foundation stones, which at some level are the Aztec temple stones, are the stones that are being drawn out from underneath the edifice of Spain, not New Spain, Spain. Spain, its capacity to have a foundation is compromised by New Spain's colonizing efforts. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. See, this is much more calamitous for the Spanish than the Spanish ever calculated, it seems to me. And this is why you can trace that entire linguistic gymnastics that New World Spanish went through to craft ever new and more color accurate words for the various admixtures of people.
The Casta paintings.
All of that stuff. It's extraordinary to see how they were trying to track what mixtures produced what kind of Spanish.
Yeah.
Right? And all the words that went along with it.
Yeah.
You can track in that the architectural observation I'm making, that the actual Spanish language is being fundamentally compromised by trying to track the consequences of the Spanish mania for determining who's Spanish and who isn't. Mm-hmm. It's actually Spanish that suffers, as diabolical as it was for the Aztecs.
Yeah.
I'm not diminishing that at all.
Sure.
But I'm just saying, here's the unauthorized half of the story. That the foundation of the churches in Spain become uneven and uncertain as a consequence of using Aztec foundation stones for the New World cathedrals.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. I'm almost seeing as that's happening and as the foundations in Spain are crumbling, you can see science coming up, you know, and swallowing that story, those foundations.
Yeah.
Because as it make new discoveries in the Americas, you know, in non-Europe,
and
you realize that the Bible story cannot integrate any of this.
Won't. Has no intention of doing so.
Right. It was never meant to.
And then track the kind of post-colonial, as if there is such a thing,
right,
by the way, the post-colonial history of the Republic of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
You say, Jesus, it's like they can't establish level one of stability at some level. Now, I'm not an adequate student, so that's probably a gross overstatement.
Mm-hmm.
But at least for a pedestrian like me, it would appear to be the case unto this moment. Okay, so I'm suggesting to you that the imbalance that seems to be part and parcel of the political circus that is Mexico is not a consequence of the utter unrooting or uprooting of the Aztec predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying it's a consequence of the anticipated scorpion's tail dilemma I described earlier. That imbalance, the inability to achieve a kind of fundamental democratic capacity, politically speaking, is the inevitable stepchild or grandchild of the willingness to do that to the Aztecs.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing when you think about it that way. The unintended consequences are so... they proliferate so thoroughly that you realize it couldn't have been a plan.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been inconceivably godly to be able to conceive of a plan that darkly efficient.
Yes.
And the irony is that that may be what is more properly meant by progress.
Can you unpack that last bit?
I don't know, but I can imagine, I can hope.
When you said that,
yeah,
progress, what is that?
Well, when I was telling you
what
I imagine to have been one of the ancillary consequences of the kind of ethnic cleansing of Aztec culture, which was not entirely successful,
right?
That one of the consequences has been the fundamental inability to establish a democratic, a democracy that's respected, politically speaking.
Right.
And I'm asking you to imagine that this is the full incarnation of practicing progress. You take out the word progress, put in Christianity, that's what we mean by practicing.
Mm-hmm.
That's if progress is a cult religion,
yeah,
which it surely is,
mm-hmm,
then the practice of that cult religion is in evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so the irony is that the mantra of progress is ever improving, right? By building upon the legitimate foundation of what preceded you. Not every foundation The legitimate foundation.
Legitimate as in like the authorized.
Yeah. The one you're willing to claim.
Yeah.
That you've been authored by.
Yeah.
Ancestrally, genetically.
Okay.
You know, politically and so on. And it may be the inadvertent full confession of progress mm-hmm. as a cult religion mm-hmm. to inadvertently understand itself in Mexican terms. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the advocates of progress would say there has been no progress in Mexico. That's what you're looking at.
Right.
And I would say, no, that's what progress is. That's what it does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it qualifies some things that you did, disqualifies other things that you did.
Mm-hmm.
Imagining that there's no genetic inheritance,
right.
I don't mean DNA, but cultural genetic inheritance that ensues from what you do not cop to.
Mm-hmm.
But there's two things that ensue from that. Mm-hmm. One, the actual material consequences that you don't allow into your official version.
Mm-hmm.
And the refusal to do so is the secondary consequence. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of willful truancy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an obdurateness that becomes part of your plan. And there's no containing that, right? There's mm-hmm. no containing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the Nazis keeping track of everything they did to the gypsies and the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
There's no containing the consequences of you trying not to lose track of what you're doing to people. And the Nuremberg trials would have been inconceivable without right. the Nazis tracking themselves, right? That's progress.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very progressive thing the Nazis did.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this and we're circumspect enough to track it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mania for keeping track of it is a whole other subject.
Yeah.
It's astounding.
History of IBM.
It's just, indeed, you know, yeah. I mean, it's not the first or the last time. It might even be the best time. But it's certainly handy for us to wonder what it means to craft for yourself an authorized version that includes improving things. And you track the means by which you do it. And the entire consequence of the tracking of it, of the willingness to track it instead of remember it, to record it instead, is you think you're one step removed from any moral ambivalence. Let's call it,
mm-hmm.
painfully call it that, mm-hmm. moral ambivalence that could stir from it.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're recording it, there's a kind of arm's length judge and jury.
So what's coming to me right now is those cuneiform tablets
yes.
behind me.
Yeah.
And if we return back to Babylon, that tracking and logging of colonization of Mesopotamia and recording it, let's say in the story of Gilgamesh that we studied with you, we talked about surplus this past week, but there's also something about archiving in order to not remember. If that might be one way that I'm trying to understand.
You write it down so you don't have to remember.
Yeah.
Well, what's wrong with remembering? Well, now don't make it a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
What's wrong with remembering? Well, but remembering's involuntary. No. Being reminded is involuntary.
Mm-hmm.
Remembering is an action, an undertaken thing.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you are reminded. One's passive, one's active.
Mm-hmm.
So when you write things down, your memory inherently becomes passive to the degree to which you're exercising one at all.
Mm-hmm.
As I've joked with you many times in the class here, that, you know, as, you know, I jokingly say, write that down.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then almost in the next sentence, like some really confusing ally, I say, you understand you're writing things down so you can forget them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can forget them.
Mm-hmm.
It's purposeful. But it's a purpose that the writing itself doesn't seem to permit you to realize.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because writing's permanent.
Mm-hmm.
So how could you ever see what I just said?
Right.
You couldn't. You would say writing as dutiful obeisance to futurity and to permanence. To enable permanence.
Mm-hmm.
To enable the future generations. You could see it that way,
yeah.
but you wouldn't be looking
yeah.
to see it that way. You'd be insisting.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask yourself about the, let's call it the kind of hermeneutical consequence of writing,
mm-hmm.
okay? If you labor over that long enough, you'll realize the direct consequence of writing anything down, including perhaps what I'm saying to you now,
mm-hmm.
is that your memory is not engaged by it. You remember that you wrote it down, yeah. But you don't remember what you wrote. Mm-hmm. For example.
Yeah.
And you can hear the project of colonization in that dilemma. Mm-hmm. How so? Because in a colonized place, you remember the colonizer, but you don't remember the colonizing.
For everybody involved? Like say
the I'm talking Spanish about on the receiving end.
So for the Aztecs.
Having been colonized,
yeah.
One of the coping strategies is to remember the conqueror.
Mm.
Okay? But not the conquering.
Yes. So if I can take it back to the Israelites, and the rivers and the shores of Babylon. Mm-hmm. Because one question I have is, when the Babylonians demand from them a song, which I understood as nostalgia, part of that might be an actual remembering. But then the Israelites' reaction is to say, we will put down our lyre, we will, you know, our tongue will cleave to the top of our mouth, we will not sing our songs anymore. In some ways, that almost feels to me like you're identifying with your colonizer, because you're like, you're refusing to sing your songs if you're not in Jerusalem, which in some ways means you've been conquered.
Yeah. This is sorry, go ahead.
But at the same time, from I know David Abrams' work on that period, that's where the phonetic alphabet comes in as a way to try to remember the Hebrew God when they're in Babylon.
You mean the phonetic alphabet, surely?
The Hebrew. Sorry, the Hebrew. Or maybe what he would call the first truly phonetic alphabet, the first truly abstracted alphabet. Have you read Spell of the Sensuous? Do you know?
I'm aware of the reference, but
yeah.
It can't possibly be
the first phonetic
of anything. No, but it doesn't demean it in any way.
Yeah.
There's an obligation to be the first.
Sure.
You see?
But that function of, let's say, protecting what is sacred to you.
By not exercising it.
Yeah. Is that itself a function of colonization?
You know, this is going to sound odd given what I've just been saying, but I'm very reluctant to generalize that way and turn it into an observation about somebody's history.
Okay.
You know, it's humility is really important when you begin to reflect this way. It's not open season. You know, that stuff's not on the Walmart shelf of ideas, and you just stick together whatever you want. Okay, so with that in mind, well, you know, being tyrannized it has obviously generational consequences, among other things. And the consequences accrue and may magnify over time, not soften. May magnify. I suspect that's what happens. And a very good example, closer to home. You want to go back to the Bible? I, who studied the Bible, not so inclined to do it, maybe. But, you know, we listened to a concert, many of the songs, last night, excuse me, and many of the songs were referring to the North, which for us is a mythic, poetic evocation up north, has enormous resonance for most Canadians, at least born here. And it does not mean mosquitoes and things like this, right? So this is a story that comes from there. So there's an old woman, old Inuit woman, and there's an interpreter and there's a journalist from the CBC. And he's interviewing her, and he goes to the rather unfortunate lengths of asking her the following question. Could you tell us a little bit about the worst thing that ever happened to your people? Now, he has no idea what he's asking, of course. He's asking about information. No, he isn't. Whether he's intending it or not is irrelevant, but he's asking her to remember, to live again, very particular somethings, which almost certainly, given Inuit culture, involve other people. So he's asking her to do what? To dig up graves. That's what he's asking her to do. Dig up graves and show him what she finds. Okay, that's the first thing. But he absolutely unhesitatingly asks. So there's already two elements of colonization at work in the dynamic. The first one is just him willing to ask her to do that with a known notion whatsoever. He thinks he's helping Southerners understand Inuit culture by doing this. And the other level is, whoever the interpreter is, agreed to interpret once this was underway.
Yeah.
And maybe the sad other level, well, you'll decide whether or not the old woman agreed to be colonized again. Mm-hmm. So he asked her this, and she, and you could see, because it was a film, piece of film from the early 60s. And she got a look on her face like, if you were to read it, it was like she wasn't quite sure either about the question mm-hmm. or about what her answer might be. Mm-hmm. And he took it to be the second one. Mm-hmm. So he began to prompt her. Mm-hmm. And he said things like, because he had done his research, or somebody had for him. And he said, well, it was at the time, well documented by Life and Look magazine, among others, when the caribou failed to pass this way for the first time since anyone could remember.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of starvation and death through the winter as a result of it.
Okay.
So she nodded and she said, yeah, that was a difficult time. Mm-hmm. But he's underwhelmed by her underwhelmedness in her answer, right? Because he's looking for the worst one. Mm-hmm. And so he goes to a next one and he says, well, was it the time when the government insisted that you live together and built that government housing mm-hmm. and took you off the land? She said, yeah, that was a hard one too. Mm-hmm. So he said to her, well, is there something worse than those things that I haven't mentioned? She didn't say yes or no. Mm-hmm. She said instead, well, she said, and she gestured with her chin to a 3-year-old grandson who was in the next room in a 2-room place. Mm-hmm. And he was watching television. Mm-hmm. Right? She gestured to her grandson, and through the interpreter, she said, well, she said, when they brought the TV, that was pretty bad. And he's dumbfounded compared to these other two things.
Right.
Dumbfounded. And he said, worse than, and he goes through the list again. She doesn't say yes or no. She said, well, she said, since they brought the TV, him and me can't talk because he doesn't speak Innu and I don't speak TV. That's the word she used, not English. There. That might be what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean about the compound fracture that actually magnifies over time, not dissipates, right? And you could call it adjustment, mm-hmm. but I would call it in the first generation trauma, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But in the second or the subsequent generations, maybe there's a medial generation for whom the trauma is being wrestled with. Mm-hmm. But in the third generation, there's no wrestling with trauma. Now it's called your life now. And they don't even say now. So in the third generation, what was trauma 2 generations ago has become your divinity, your deity. That's the axis around which your accommodated life turns. Right?
And there's an architecture to that that's very
diabolical.
Central and diabolical.
Yeah.
Do you know about the runrig system in the Highlands of Scotland, the way it used to be? So what it was, through the winter, everybody would be down the valley in the farm. Summer comes, the grandparents and the grandchildren would go up with the livestock into the mountains.
Already sounds perfect.
Right? And while the parents stay down under the farm, the summer is spent in these, kind of lean-to shelings. And that's where the stories are shared, the songs, the dances, the drinking, that's where they have time.
Yeah.
And that's, so the mountains are where that, I don't want to call it transference.
It's a kind of hedge school, as they call it in other places.
Hedge school is quite literal, like
hedge school.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're learning on the mountain. It's those 2 generations.
Let me push and say,
yes.
You're learning mountain, not on the mountain.
Yeah.
It's not the stage for it.
Right.
It's the it. You're learning mountain. And it's a better word even than mountainess mm-hmm. or mountainishness mm-hmm. or the ways of the mountain.
Yeah.
No, just say you're learning mountain and understand it to be partly a language.
Yeah.
And with all that means, mm-hmm. partly an ontology, mm-hmm. partly an epistemology, that's what mountain is.
Yeah.
And there's a reason we once called them mountain people.
Yeah.
You could have just as easily called them mountainish.
Yeah.
And probably some English people did. Mm-hmm. And mountain people, it was never used as a term of endearment.
No.
Even by the townies in Scotland, It wouldn't have taken long before mountain people was not something you wanted to be. Absolutely. Those are the ones who are toothless, mm-hmm. right, and don't have no shoes. Mm-hmm. So there's the trauma mm-hmm. articulated as a deity. Yeah. And a deity is relative civility, literacy, a toilet somewhere, mm-hmm. things of this nature, mm-hmm. right?
So is there, what I'm understanding is, because I'm going back to Huron relations, something mm-hmm. we read here right. about the Jesuit conquest and conversion of this part of the country, where not just the elders, but the role of elderhood is, what's this, usurped, perhaps, by colonization or by the
colonizer? Disqualified, really.
Disqualified.
It's not like it's transferred to some other French presence.
But is not the deification the kind of replacement or the kind of projection onto, let's say, the god that's brought in or the role of elderhood that's brought in, whether that's...
Sorry, the question, yeah. Can you say it again?
That if you picture Scotland, let's say, mm-hmm. and when that... Let's say when English came in and the grandchildren started learning English and not Gaelic, which means they can't learn mountain right. in the mountains or within right. the mountains from
they
their
even
elders.
They could be there possibly that, and not learn mountain.
Right.
Yeah.
That the coping with that is where the deification comes in. And rather than elders, your own actual elders, being that, being your mountain, which, you know, they understood as the ultimate elder, I mean, gods. Whatever has been brought and whatever has been dragged in there becomes the divinity or the elder. And I don't want to
I know what
make
your question,
those things the same thing.
I believe I should say I know what your question
okay.
is. But I would prefer to keep the agility of the mind engaged. Mm-hmm. That instead of imagining elder mm-hmm. as a kind of holding place mm-hmm. that you just plug something in, pull that out, plug something else in, you still have the dynamics of elder. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to imagine that you can't actually do it. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
Because when you pluck the elder out of, or you disqualify or you shame the elder, whatever it is, mm-hmm. Of course that person bears the bitterness of all of that, mm-hmm. but it's elderhood mm-hmm. that is going into disarray. It's not that elder. You
right.
can't replace them.
The function.
With a conqueror-derived equivalent.
Right.
That's not what'll happen. Mm-hmm. They won't plug in an English bailiff. Well, obviously not. I mean, but let's say you're trying to make a go of it two generations down the road. Mm-hmm. And that means trying to get enough food to eat and things like this. Mm-hmm. So you're going to cooperate. Mm-hmm. And you're going to speak English, at least on the job.
Right.
All of these things ensue, right?
Yeah.
And then before you know it, you're forgetting the names for things, mm-hmm. using Buddy's names for things.
Yeah.
And this is how it rolls, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not simple-minded enough to imagine that they just plug in English equivalents and
right.
it's the same thing.
Right.
There are no English equivalents to the elders on the mountain.
Right.
Why? What are you saying about the English? Same thing I said about the Spanish in Mexico. Mm-hmm. On the other side of Culloden and other things like this,
yeah.
the English capacity to have elders themselves mm-hmm. is so fundamentally compromised mm-hmm. that there is no English equivalent to put in
right.
the vacated elder throne in the Highlands of Scotland. Mm-hmm. For the Scots, it's not available.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's how devastating it is.
Yeah.
Is that the working understanding of elderhood is an early and often permanent casualty mm-hmm. of colonization. Because mm-hmm. they often go there first. And you read that in Brebeuf. He literally says, well, we've had a pretty good run at the elders lately. Mm-hmm. And he says, there's not many of them left. But those, what? Already you should be going. And he says, but those on the left are still pretty stubborn. Mm-hmm. And the good news is, I boxed them into a corner, because he's using his rhetoric.
So this is the Jesuit missionary
yeah,
that we're talking about.
His
yeah.
Socratic teaching, which he learned at the Jesuit seminary in France.
Yeah.
He's employing it now. He says, I often box them into a corner. And when they have no way out, and they just grin sheepishly and are humiliated before their countrymen, and they say they simply don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's how we... So you can see the program of discrediting. Yeah. And it's not that the Hurons, in this case, looked at Brebeuf and the other Jesuit missionaries and simply enthroned them instead. It's not what happened. Mm-hmm. There was no throne. There was no throne. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that's what deification is. Mm-hmm. It's not replacing. It's the inadvertent willingness to live in the absence of it. Okay. That's what the golden calf idea is. Mm-hmm. See? Real deification is not trading one God for another. Mm-hmm. It's trading godlessness, if you want to use that phrase, mm-hmm. for God. Mm-hmm. In much the same way that I've claimed over and over again that psychology today is the secularized version of monotheism. Mm-hmm. There's just no God in it. Yeah. But functionally, it works virtually the same because that's where it learned the dynamics from. Mm-hmm. Right? It's and you could say that hope, as we talked about earlier, and progress mm-hmm. are a kind of secularized salvation. And if you just think those thoughts through, you realize, this is not replacement. This is not plug that one out, plug that one in. Mm-hmm. No, the real deification deifies the trauma, mm-hmm. not the replacement deity. It deifies the trauma instead. Mm. And calls the trauma the new world order. Calls the trauma adjusting. Mm-hmm. Calls the trauma... Well, we made the best of it. Mm-hmm. Calls the trauma, we're still around. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. People who've been through a lot of stuff, the mere existence of their capacity to have a house of worship. I'm just thinking now because I taught in Berlin a few months ago.
Yeah.
And my hotel was literally down the street from the synagogue that was the center of the Kristallnacht. Mm-hmm. It was on the same road. And as I walked by, and I think to myself, why are the police standing here? Because I didn't register the building behind. Mm-hmm. You see these cops looking bored as shit, and you realize they're not going anywhere.
But you could tell that was like a fixture.
And then it hits you, this is their assignment
to
be here. And I'm looking around for what could possibly be. And then I see their little kiosk. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at the plaque behind the kiosk beside the door of this rather ornate building. Mm-hmm. And then it went like that. It all lined up very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's more a community center, actually, because there was only an edifice left after the fires, right? So the edifice is what's still there.
Okay.
My point in saying this is, I'm not trying to disqualify the remnant aspects of a culture been through unthinkable degradation. And saying that that's not the thing. It's not for me to say at all. But I'm simply imagining what the consequences are of a chronic the reason I'm hesitating is because a memory of having just taught in Israel has come to my mind. So for what it's worth.
Sure.
This is very, very edgy territory to talk about these things like this. So I'll just allow that. Mm-hmm. So here's what happened. The guy who's showing me around, let's imagine he's around 45 or 50 years old. Okay, so he's the second generation born there. Mm-hmm. First generation of founders in and around, let's say, to make it simple, mid-40s onto the 48. Mm-hmm. Okay, who were they? Well, by and large, if this doesn't diminish it too unnecessarily, the founding peoples of Israel were of the generation of traumatized Eastern European Jewry, mm-hmm. for the most part, as I understand it. I could be completely wrong, so throw this out if I am wrong, mm-hmm. factually. But that's the way it strikes me, at least from the story he was telling me.
Okay.
Because here's the story. So that's their parents. Now, his generation is in their 40s and 50s, which is the kind of prime place to be cultural workers and cultural conscience, and all of those things are manifest there. Now, his children are the third generation born there as Jews in the state of Israel.
Yeah.
his children are all right-wing, gun-toting, do away with the Palestinians, up with the wall, unauthorized settlement of kibbutzes in contested land, etc. That's his kid's generation.
Yeah.
He's absolutely undone by it, right? Because he's hamstrung between a number of allegiances. One of them is, do you honor your parents? Of course you do. How do you do it? You think well of their efforts on your behalf. But wait, their efforts on our behalf have had extraordinary consequences, and not just for us, for other peoples as well, that we're trying to find a way to live with. And we can't. Why not? Because of the measures our parents took on our behalf. That's why not. We are the kind of reluctant beneficiaries of a confounding arrangement. And what do our children do? They emulate their grandparents and bypass the pacifist generation that seems now not to be an authentic Israeli presence, because they're so troubled by the moral back and forthness of it all. You see? So it's come to a point, he tells me, where the capacity to opt, not opt out, to be contrary-wise in your take on the history, the wall, the treatment of the Palestinians, and a host of other things, is now tantamount to being not only unfaithful to the founding principles of the culture, but fundamentally treasonous, and you know what the next word is. Nazi. That's the next word. And when a Jew calls another Jew a Nazi, I can only guess what it all means and where it goes. Okay? But that's in the air. This is what he was telling me.
Yeah.
This is a lived out version of our discussion earlier. Yeah. And these generations are all alive in the same place. So you can, I think, do something of the math in these other places that we're imagining or talking about, like Highland Scotland, like Mexico City, and other places as well. And imagine that this, of course, doesn't happen in a week, and we both know that. And that people don't, quote, change their mind because they change their clothing to fit in. Okay? But there's a process that the coping generation cannot afford to be alert to and still cope. That's what I'm imagining. And that's what I mean by the unauthorized stories that simply don't break the surface, because they don't work with coping. They seem regressive. That's the old stuff, whatever it is. Right? So that stuff's banished. And that's the final victory of the conquest. Is the conquered people being willing to live without the contested and troubling memory of a time before this. By the time a subsequent generation does that, what are they doing? Well, it's turned into a kind of a little bit of a holy crusade without a holy land. And it's a little bit of a program of kind of revival that's more festival oriented than anything else. And we call it celebrating our cultural whatever it is. And what it actually is the dances and the songs. Don't get me wrong, they're great. But that's what you do instead. Instead of overturning the thing and going to the hedge school and saying, you know, the fundamental way of acting in the name of re-galicizing, perhaps, if that's a word, of the circumstance is, among other things, to stop thinking in English. Whoa, well, how are you going to be a global player if you're going to stop thinking in English? Why? Well, because not just English, but every language carries the ancestry of colonization in it. Everyone does. Every language that doesn't come from here, that's being spoken now, drags all this along with it. And here's the image. We're probably coming to the end of our time. But so I live on a river here. And one of the solutions that have been engaged in by people who live on the river now, who are known as cottagers, who I'm saying to you, do not live on the river. They live on a recreation opportunity site. That's what it's become. Do you know what they do in front in the river, in front of their place? They get an old mattress frame. You know the old ones where the spring was in the, like a metal,
like almost in a cage
frame. Like just a thin metal frame.
Okay.
And the springs were in it. This is old school. You don't see this stuff anymore. So they take that, okay, tie it to the back of their boat, put it in the water, and drag it back and forth across the river bottom in front of their place to do what? To get rid of the weeds. So you don't have that kind of viscous sensibility when you walk in the water. So the kids can swim and all that. Well, that's what colonization seems to me to be. When your grandchildren are swimming in a place that you did that to, and you continue to call that the river. But that's not what it is. But your kids agree that that's what a river is, because that's your encounter with riverness. That's it.
It's quite an image.
It's all there. And it's observable. And every time a kid goes into the water, when they turn into a grown-up, what are they expecting when they walk in there? Okay. So when they're in an actual river, what is it? It's in need of maintenance. Where's the bed springs? Or the equivalent, you know?
We have them. We'll invent them. Maybe as a way of kind of gliding down, coming in on Israel. Before we started, I mentioned that a lot of my research is tracing culture through walking practices. And so I don't know if you've heard of the Tiulim, which was the Zionist kind of wilderness hiking program that started in the 1920s in Palestine, where you'd bring people out and you'd, you know, walk the wilderness, the desert of Palestine, and remembering, you know, this happened in the Bible here, this was there. So kind of what might be thought of as remembering and kind of being like, this happened here, this happened there. But the itineraries never went anywhere close to Arab settlements. So the idea was that this is empty wilderness, and this progressed for several decades. The Holocaust happens, and right after that, and the state of Israel being authorized, it changes and it goes to summiting Masada, and that becomes a pilgrimage. So this site of resistance during the Roman occupation in the first century. And so what I've been tracing is that this need for belonging or remembering or authenticity, connection to land, at the same time the consequences of it seem to be uprooting or displacing other peoples, this tension.
Well, in a finite world.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
No, probably if you have an ancestral memory that's intact, absolutely, not eventually.
Yeah.
Ongoingly. I mean, the only way you can get away with saying eventually is imagining that there's no enduring history that accrues to place. But that's the only place history is. So, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, so I think the question, you know, Hugh Brody talks about that tension between the desire to settle and fix and have home and the desire to see what's beyond the horizon or to exploration and adventure, and that's the condition of agriculturalists, is this tension between these two desires that cannot be...
I don't think so at all. Yeah. I mean, with all due respect to Hugh, on this one, it seems to me that the principal desire vector of agriculture is very simply observed. One generation, you have five children to help you with the work of 100 acres.
Yeah.
But the next generation, you have five claimants to the 100 acres. So, and usually it's primogeniture, right?
Yeah.
The firstborn, or the hopefully that's also the one most able, but usually having been exposed to the farming life tends to be so, that they are the most able.
Yeah.
And they've assumed the responsibility being the firstborn, blah. So ends up being what? What happens to the other four if the one inherits 100 acres? How are they continue to be farmers? And you're looking at, among other things, where the fodder for the Industrial Revolution is to be found. Where the workforce comes from.
Second and third sons.
Yeah. The scions, I think that's the technical term for them. The ones who will never inherit much beyond a pittance, right? And you go up the nobility chain, it's virtually the same thing as well.
Right.
So by definition, agricultural societies are expansionist to remain agricultural. Because alternative is to agree to live within the limits of the land base you got.
Right.
Oh yeah, no agricultural culture agrees to limit itself that way.
Right. I think the other thing is when those second and third sons go off beyond the horizon, it's almost like those kids, the grandkids in the river, they're not satisfied with what is there. They need to develop it in order to recreate the the home that they've left. Would you agree to that?
Not only that, but you know, an undeveloped place to an agriculturalist is a waste.
Yeah.
Or it's a potential. I can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
Myself. If it's not anything yet.
Yeah.
Well, these are people who traffic in two fundamental concepts. And one of them's hope, and the other one's progress.
Yeah.
And that's the full circle of what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the agriculturalists invented progress.
Yeah.
But I'm saying not only were they aided and abetted by it, but they're the vectors of hopeful progress in the world.
Okay.
And they became me, you know. Yeah. So my little response to this historical alertness or anxiety, if you want to call it that, here is, oh, you're doing this. You could say that and you wouldn't be entirely wrong. But we have a small mixed farm on 65 acres. And what are we doing? We have 6, 7, 8, 9, including the little ones, 10 people that live here. Largely, they're living from what we're able to manage to produce on the land.
Okay.
We are not growing. We say, but you got 8, 9, or 10 people. Yes, that's true. But what I'm trying to do is not recreate pre-Mesopotamian history here. What I'm trying to do is conduct myself in the presence of all the history since then. And, you know, your classes, that you, when you come to the school, are fed in the self-same fashion. And it's a small mixed farm, which means animals are part of it, which means animals live their lives only on this place and die here by our hand. Okay. I am not saying by this that we're doing anything heroic nor progressive. What I'm saying is that we're willing to live by virtue of a covenantal understanding of our obligations to the land and to its various denizens. And the covenant comes to this. In terms of domestication, we have sheep, for example. Yes, they, of course, they conceive and they give birth here, basically on our doorstep in that time. It's the only time they agree to let us really come close to them. And they really do. I mean, we're right there sometimes if you have to be.
Yeah.
You know, you can be, though we've never quite done this, but you can have your hand right up onto the unborn one, trying to help them come out. My point is, at some level, there seems to be, and I don't think this is anthropomorphism speaking, there seems to be a willingness, I don't know what else to call it, among the ewes to have us close to them for a while. Whether they quote-unquote understand that we're trying to be helpful, I don't really know. But I know as much as this. They don't refuse to conceive. They don't withhold. They don't dry up. They don't close up. They give birth on our doorstep, okay? All instinctually driven things for them.
Yeah.
What is our, so that establishes a covenant, that willingness to do so and to act on it. What's our end of the covenant? Well, we're not sheep and we can't be sheep, but we are responsible for sheep health. I'll go one step further and call it sheepness. We can't practice it, but we have some responsibilities to it. Because we benefit from it. Okay? So our translation of that responsibility is covenantal. And it goes like this. Your willingness to conceive and deliver on our doorstep and include us in some fashion in that. And we benefit thereby, though I'm not saying they let us benefit. We obviously seize them. We obviously kill them. That's true. But our responsibility is to the individual sheep, but through them to sheep health or sheepness. And how do we act on that? You have to have a kind of radical assessment of what constitutes sheepness. And it's not lots of sheep. You don't get more sheepness with more sheep.
Right.
Okay? Because too many sheep in one place degrades their health.
Yeah.
Ah, so now you have to know where the limits are, which is dictated partly by your pasturage. So this very maybe overly detailed story. But when it comes time to deciding about the slaughtering in the fall, the volume of the slaughter is dictated by the health of the sheep, how many sheep there are, which genders they are, and the health of the pasturage. Exactly what would happen in the wild.
Right.
Item by item, the same. But we have to act on it. Why? Because there's no natural force or presence, because it's been banished by domestication. So we have to inhabit the, I'm loath to call it natural function. Mm-hmm. We have to inhabit the position of guarantor of sheep health. Mm-hmm. Because the previous occupant of that position, we banished mm-hmm. by the mechanics of domestication. Mm-hmm. Who am I talking about? The predator. Mm-hmm. Okay, the predator is the fundamental guarantor of sheep health. Yeah. So our responsibility is to assume the predator's role. Bingo. Mm-hmm. There it is. There's the covenant. And that will absolutely overwhelm your untested sense of right and wrong mm-hmm. as a human. Mm-hmm. And it tests your sense of privilege and responsibility and ownership. All of those matters are up for grabs. So I call it covenantal, not as a cover story mm-hmm. for getting what we want, but assuming a degree of burdensome, frankly heartbreaking responsibility every year. So picture this, they're born in the spring and you're rooting for them and you're doing everything and you're up all night long with everything you can do, mm-hmm. knowing full well that if they drop and you see testicles, you know you're going to be killing them in 7 months. Mm. That very one.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not pleasure. It's mm-hmm. something deeper. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a participation in something that confounds your desire to feel that you're on the right side of the story. You have to understand the story, but you can only occupy one position in it. You're not the narrator. See? So in that sense, you know, we'll stop with this.
Yeah.
That the progress with that you began this with. No, let me talk about elderhood and the sheep flock instead.
Yeah.
Who are the elders in the sheep flock? And the answer is the ewes, the old ewes. Okay. What about the old rams? There are no old rams in a domesticating environment like this. Why aren't there? Because you can't keep the same ram around for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Because after 2 full years of that procreative cycle, they're too close genetically to who they would be mating the following year. Mm. So you're creating all kinds of problems for everyone.
Okay.
Mostly the sheep. Yeah. So you've got to ship them out. Trade it with another farmer who you hope is...
The rams.
Yes, yeah. The rams, but not the ewes. Yeah. The ewes are your foundation yeah. stock, right? And you have the same ewe, in our case, 5 years, I think. The, mm-hmm. the oldest one is around 5 years old. She knows the place very well. She knows us at some level, you can tell. Yeah. She's glad to be rid of us come late spring when we turn them out in the pastures.
Yeah.
And she doesn't see us again until... Basically till September, mm. and she's thrilled, but she somehow knows, and we shear her, and you can tell. Mm-hmm. And there's something about her that's available to the other ewes, the younger ewes. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of transmission, if you will, that might include at some crazy level, you see these uprights who don't eat grass, God only knows why. Well, here's the thing. They're troubling at some times of year, and we mysteriously... reduce in numbers at other times of year. Mm-hmm. But overall, our capacity to eat and to pasture and so on seems to involve them. Mm-hmm. I'm not expressing a cause and effect. Just seems to be they're in on it as a peripheral lunatic fringe. Mm-hmm. And watch me proceed accordingly. Mm. And because you know the protective instinct of the herd is to run. Mm-hmm. And so they're... The defense against the predator is the slowest one. That's everybody else's defense, mm-hmm. right? But they don't run. There's nowhere to run.
Right.
So that order doesn't quite work. Mm-hmm. So the other one is submission. They actually do that. If you get them down, they instantly stop. And I believe that's probably ancestrally derived from if you go absolutely stock still, mm-hmm. you might throw off the kill scent or instinct of the predator mm-hmm. because there's no struggle. Which probably inflames
what kind of gets off
predation.
Kind of,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, all of this is to say simply this, that instead of the notion of progress, that we're building a bigger farm, a better farm, a farm that's more worthy of being called a farm, we're actually in a mysterious way doing something almost Neolithic in its scale. Mm-hmm. We have no machinery. We do everything by hand. Nothing heroic about it. We just couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. That's all it meant. And then it's become the way we do it. So nothing is tractor reliant. And there's no plowing. Well, there's pigs. The pigs mm-hmm. do the plowing. Mm-hmm. And so and so and so and so and so. Mm-hmm. My point is, we can't find two things here. We can't find a guaranteed human elder sequence to rely upon. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have to try to establish it by crafting the ability to have human elderhood among us. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have it.
Yeah.
The second thing is, our responsibility is to reimagine our endeavor, not as ever improving on anything, but as an act of memory. Mm-hmm. Everything's done in memoriam. And our memory is our antidote to our progressive instinct. Because mostly what you remember is how desperately you fucked it up. Mm. For the right reasons, you did the wrong thing. And it only means you're not going to do that wrong thing again.
And is that limits?
Nothing but. The limits is what makes the farm, yeah. Even at the level of the fencing.
Right.
On the other side of the fence, what is it? Well, it's not a farm. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. And there's parts of the 65 acres that we never go to. And we've never fenced. Mm-hmm. And we don't graze. Mm-hmm. And we never go. We never dig, plow, mm-hmm. extract in any way. Why? As a memory mm-hmm. of a time when this was true of this whole place. Mm-hmm. So there's a little corridor that the deer can pass through in the wintertime without going too close to the house mm-hmm. and dealing with the dog picking up their scent.
Yeah.
It's a little thing.
Yeah.
Of course, if everybody did it and it was a contiguous piece of land
yeah.
from one owner to the next, what would it be? Well, it'd be the beginnings of some radicalized memory that it hasn't always been farms.
Mm.
In fact, it's virtually never been farms until the last
yeah.
120 years.
Yeah. And that's what you've called the wilderness in your book.
Well, the wilderness is on the other side, you know, and you could say the farm, from the point of view of the city, the farm is the medial zone.
Yeah.
It's the mediator. Mm-hmm. You know, the farm is as close as the city should get to the country.
Yeah.
That's a way of saying it.
Yeah. All right, that feels like a beautiful place to land. Mm-hmm. For those of you who haven't come across you before, orphanwisdom.com would be the website to go to see what you're up to and see your several books.
And we're probably coming to a city near you.
Yes. So
in the fall, we got a tour with a band.
Uh-huh.
Imagine all of this stuff as a musical. I don't know how else to say it, but that's what it is. It's called Nights of Grief and Mystery, and we have a 25-city tour through North America in the fall of this year, 2018. And if there's enough request for a bigger and better version, though not more progressed version of it, we were in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK in 2017, and we'd be happy to return if there's enough will in that regard. So be in touch if you'd like to.
Okay.
But meanwhile, we'll take it on the road and see if it stands.
Okay. When do you kick off? When do you head out?
I think late September.
Late September.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And again, orphanwisdom.com if anybody wants to get more info. Your new book, Come of Age, is available.
It just came out about 3 weeks ago, and
okay.
Die Wise prior to that, and a couple of other things, and I found it worth the effort, those little couple of little things. So I wouldn't hesitate to recommend them, though I'm not clear that I'm recommending the writer, but the writing might bear some scrutiny.
I hope my willingness to return to your farm over and over is an expression of my gratitude for what you have taught and the stories that you carry. And the work that you do.
Thank you.
In this life.
And thank you for this.
Thank you for this as well. Okay. Thanks, Steve. Okay.